Welcome back to Presidents and Politics. I am one of your hosts, Professor Caleb McGee, joined by my fellow co-host, former Congressman Ross.
Good morning.
Today we're going to talk Warren G. Harding, the 29th president, and we're dealing with the beginning of the 1920s.
Yes, and probably one of the least impressive presidents we've ever had.
Can we use the term the most, well, I don't know if I can say the most, but one of the most corrupt presidents in U.S. history?
Yes.
By far. So he's another Ohio-born president. So many of
seven, I think seven are.
It's the leading state right now, isn't it?
I know
Virginia,
yeah.
Of course, in the early days would have been leading, but then Ohio kind of takes over as being the leading president-making state. And he led a group that was literally known as the Ohio Gang. That's how corrupt they were in his cabinet. But a very, very corrupt individual, not only politically, but also morally, ethically.
And he didn't necessarily want to be president.
No.
He wanted to do what he loved doing and being a publisher of a small-town
newspaper.
He's a newspaper
man.
Loves a newspaper.
Loves being a newspaper man.
And in fact, I ran across a quote because when he was by far not expected to be president.
No.
He was an unimpressive U.S. senator.
He was unimpressive throughout his life in a lot of ways.
Yes. And when they went to the Republican Party convention in 1922, and they went through, I think, 10 ballots. And then finally, they brought up Warren G. Harding, and one of the senators, Senator Franklin Brandegee of Connecticut, said, "There ain't any first raters this year. We got a lot of second raters, and Warren Harding is the best of the second raters." You know, and that kind of sets the stage for what we get as a president.
Does that remind you of some other elections?
Oh, yes. And that's the thing about this, though, Caleb, is that people don't understand. We've had bad presidents.
Yeah.
We've had very corrupted presidents.
Yes.
We've had very vicious presidents.
And we've had some questionable elections along the way.
Yes, we have. One that took 3 months to decide who the president was going to be.
1824, which is exactly 200 years from this election.
Yes.
Somebody said to,
so we've lived this as a nation.
Multiple
times. So don't get all upset just because, you know, you think that this is the apocalypse, but this is the worst election in the world. It probably isn't.
Right.
It's not a great one.
Right.
But it is stuff that we have endured as Americans, and we will continue to endure.
Agreed. And this is one of the things you and I have talked about a lot in class. We're teaching a class together. And you and I have talked about a lot about this to our students, that the whole point of politicizing the campaign is that many times the common, average, ordinary grassroots individual says politics is so corrupt I want nothing to do with it.
Correct.
And the more individuals that do that, the more the fringe element then begins to control the government.
Amen. And that's what could be our downfall.
Yes.
And we could be on target for that.
But Warren G. Harding, he's a newspaper man, so he gets his bachelor's of science, kind of tries a lot of different things,
is
unsuccessful in almost everything he does. He toys that he's going to law school, doesn't really have the mind to go to law school, toys that going to other different jobs. He tries to be a professional sailor for a while, all kinds of just random things. And then him and some buddies buy a fledgling newspaper in Ohio for $300.
Yes.
Can you imagine buying a newspaper, like a business, for $300? And he's actually pretty good at it.
He's pretty good
at running this newspaper. And then he'll marry a wealthy woman by the name of Florence. I think he calls her Flossie.
Yes.
She's 10 years older than him. She has one son.
Mm-hmm.
She kind of, I don't know how to say this, she kind of helps run him, I guess. She kind of becomes his political man. That's a good way of putting it. I'm trying to think of a way to use that.
Yes.
Yeah. I guess from a Freudian way, she definitely kind of mothers him. And she kind of pushes him both to expand the paper because he actually has a nervous breakdown at one point, and she'll run the paper. And when he's kind of recuperating from this nervous breakdown and she's running the paper actually grows under her. But one of the things unique about Harding is he's kind of a partier.
He's a gambler.
And he is a womanizer.
Oh.
It was estimated that when he was in the White House, he kept 7 mistresses at one time.
Wow.
That was the estimate. So we look at, we think of presidents like Kennedy, right?
Yeah.
First thing we think of was like Kennedy and the Marilyn Monroe scandal and all this kind of stuff, or Bill Clinton and the Lewinsky scandal. This guy was keeping at least 7 mistresses at one time.
He was. In fact, he fathered a child with an 18-year-old girl.
Yes, Nan Britton.
Yeah.
And here's where it gets really, really, really scandalous. He knows that he fathers this child. He'll never see the child, but he'll pay child support. And he sends the Secret Service to pay Nan the child support in person every month. He'll send the Secret Service. So, you have a president who has 7 mistresses at one time, who fathered an illegitimate daughter with an 18-year-old, and is paying off child support by sending the Secret Service as a personal carrier to do this.
And he sends one of his mistresses during the campaign of 1920, her and her husband, on an all-expense-paid trip to
Japan.
Asia, Japan.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And gives them cash and says, "Have a great time. We'll see you after the election."
It's estimated that she's paid over $300,000 as presidency, and some of that money is coming from the GOP.
Hmm.
The GOP is actually cutting checks to pay off his mistresses.
Yeah. There is a the whole thing is set for failure.
It is again. I know we keep coming back to this, but it is one of the most corrupt presidencies in American history.
And it's interesting. We go into 1920 election. Just coming off the heels of World War I, where we lost 100,000 Americans.
Yes.
They had the Spanish flu, where we had lost 650,000 Americans. And then the White Sox, which were deemed the Black Sox.
The Black Sox scandal.
Yeah, you know, because of the scandal there. So this whole – and there's labor strikes going on.
The railroad strikes.
There was a bombing in Wall Street, I think 28 people.
That's correct.
There's a lot of upheaval.
Yes. Tumultuous times.
Yes. We've seen that before, even in modern times. And that leads us to this election of the second Raiders. And it's interesting because he picks Calvin Coolidge as his running mate, and then the Franklin Roosevelt is the vice presidential running mate on the Democrat side.
That's right.
But they get whooped overwhelmingly.
And he's pretty much unknown. Nobody knows who this guy is, but who cares? It's like this strange guy from the South who's got kind of a weird accent, and he'll contract polio, of course. Mm-hmm. So they're like, no one really cares about Roosevelt. He's considered a no-known kind of loser, and then he'll win four terms of president in just a couple decades.
Yep. Change the whole course of this country and the involvement of government in our lives.
Oh, my goodness, the New Deal. We'll save that for, I guess, next semester, because that's when we'll get to this. But Hardin is – he's a partier. He's very laid back. He really wants to just drink, gamble, and womanize. But his wife, who knows that he's womanizing, pushes his ambition to the presidency. And many have said it's because she wants the power. Now, there's a few reasons for this. First of all, she is very much into women's rights. We can – use the term early feminist.
True.
And she'll be the first woman to vote for her husband, because the 19th Amendment has just passed for women's suffrage. So Hardin is the first president who will win on the votes of women. And there's a few interesting things about this. He runs an entire campaign, as you were talking about, the tumultuous years. It's so tumultuous, so bloody and broken. And his entire campaign slogan is return to normalcy.
Return to normalcy.
Return to normalcy. Which I love that. We kind of need that again, honestly.
It's a great slogan, but what is normal? You know, let's define that.
That's an entire ethical question. Let's define what that is. But his entire desire is to bring life back to normal. And it resonates with the female voter. And I find that really interesting, because he wins by a landslide, and specifically he wins the female vote overwhelming. I don't have the numbers in front of me. I don't know what it is. But not only does he win by the popular vote by a landslide, but of those demographics, he wins the female vote by a landslide. And one of the things that he runs for is return to normalcy. So if we're going to play with it psychologically, maybe it's that need for security. And his whole entire idea is, let's have just a safe, stable, normal government. We're tired of the great wars. We're tired of this.
And he reduces the size of the U.S. Navy.
Yes, he does.
You know, I mean, he says
it's a cutback, which kills us in two decades when we go to World War II. Then we're building frantically to try to catch up with Hitler and Mussolini and the Japanese Imperial Navy. It was a disastrous decision by a disastrous politician. That rhymed, but he wasn't even trying to do that. I feel like
it begins the policy of appeasement, I think.
Yeah, we'll get into this more, but the policy of appeasement, it starts here. The policy of appeasement is saying in the 1920s, but specifically the 1930s, we were so traumatized by war that we don't want to go to war again.
We will appease them. We will,
whatever they want, they can have. Mm-hmm. I hear students all the time when I'm teaching history survey classes, and they say, how did Hitler come to power? How did Mussolini come to power? How did the Nazi power get so bad? How did the concentration camps happen? Appeasement.
Absolute appeasement.
We don't want to go to war. We're afraid to go to war. We're afraid of the results of war. We saw what war looked like, and you can have whatever you want to have so long as we don't have to go to war.
Correct.
And I always tell my students, we always do a whole class on this. We talk about the idea of militarism, diplomacy, and appeasement. And we talk the idea of what are these three things. And throughout American history, we fall in some of these camps, right?
Right.
And in Congress, of course, you have hawks and doves. I know you're obviously very familiar with this. But we also have the idea, what is true diplomacy? How can you not appease and not always be wanting to go to war? And I always tell my students this analogy. I always say, we had this guy in my church years and years ago. It's a little old guy, such a cool guy. And his older buddies, always had this thing after church social where they would steal his dessert. And it was like this ongoing gag. And I told my students, like, here's a perfect small analogy of this. So when they stole his pie, appeasement would be like, I don't want the pie, have it, right? Militantism would be reaching across the table, punching them in the face, and taking your pie back. But is there something in between? Well, this little old gentleman was so clever that he came up with the idea that when he saw this continue to happen, one Sunday after the social began, he went and got his dessert. He set his pie down. He had to go fill his drink up, and he figured they'd steal his pie. So he looked at every one of them as they're sitting there, picks up the pie, and he licks the pie, and he sits it back down in front of him. And he goes and gets his coffee. Nobody steals his pie. That's diplomacy. So I always tell my students, learn how to lick the pie. Learn what it means to lick the pie. How can we protect our assets without appeasing and without necessarily having to go to war first? Now, sometimes war is necessary, right?
Yeah.
But how do we learn how to lick the pie? And I think as America, we do a really poor job of licking the pie.
Absolutely.
And in the 20s, and specifically in the 30s, it is the time of appeasement.
Absolutely.
And it leads to the greatest global disasters ever taken place, and one of the greatest humanitarian efforts that ever happened, when you look at the Holocaust and the amount of individuals who genocide.
And we sat idly by.
And we sat idly by because we believe strongly in the policy of appeasement. We were engulfed with this idea of normalcy, because it was even Hardin who said, we don't need heroics, we need healing.
Yeah.
Like, don't be a hero. Just...
What a guy, though. You know, I mean, he, in violation of prohibition, he served alcohol, you know, frequently in the White House, or then the executive mansion.
Because he thought he was above the law.
Yeah.
And that's really the issue with his life in general, is that the rules didn't apply to him.
Yes.
They applied to everyone else, but to him and the Ohio gang, they did not apply. Now, obviously, I don't know if you want to get into this or not, the kind of the most well-known scandal is the Teapot Dome scandal.
Oh, the Teapot Dome scandal. I mean, think of this. The Secretary of Interior, who's charged with maintaining and managing all federal lands, decides to lease federal lands to oil barons.
Yep.
And in doing so, he gets kickbacks, he gets gifts, he gets all kind of things.
Yep.
And gets exposed for it and goes to jail for it. But it's just one of many scandals that permeate his administration. And he's only president for 2 years.
Yes.
He's only president for two years.
Yet has more scandals than almost anyone else. And we can come back to some of his administration. But I want to talk about how you said he's only president for 2 years. His death is a little mysterious.
Yes.
So he's the first president to visit Alaska, which is hard to believe. We've had the territory for quite a while, but he's the first president, I guess we should say seating president in that role, in that capacity as president, who will go and visit Alaska. He's on this Western tour. I guess it's kind of the midterms, if you will. So he's doing the tour route. He's in Alaska, and he starts feeling ill. They don't know what's really going on with him. So he starts coming back down the West Coast, and they get him over to San Francisco, which is one of the largest cities in the West at this time. They take him to the Palace Hotel.
And the presidential suite.
Yes, the presidential suite, which I was reading on this the other day, and that same suite I think is like $8,000 a night now. Whew. If you want to stay there. So, hey, next time you're in California, if you want to go to California.
Couldn't even do it for a minute.
Right? He's in California staying in the presidential suite, and he is dying. It gets really serious. They bring in several doctors. And then he rallies, and everyone's like, oh, he's going to be fine now. And he dies.
Yeah.
And no one's really sure why. And here's where it gets just really, really, really
kind of
sketchy.
They didn't do an autopsy.
On his wife's request, Flossie, as he called her, denies the right of an autopsy, even after having doctors request the autopsy because the death is so mysterious.
Mm.
And she says, no, we will not have an autopsy. Here's where it's even weirder. And this is kind of controversial in history, but it appears as if she requests the body to be embalmed basically an hour after his death after denying the autopsy.
Wow.
So because of this, a lot of the scuttlebutt starts going around and saying, you know what? His wife probably poisoned him. Now, there's no historical evidence of that whatsoever.
Maybe it was the eighth mistress that got her. Finally said, that's enough.
That was right. Maybe so.
You know?
But there's no historical evidence of this. But it's really sketchy. And he dies. And here's what's so amazing. He is beloved by the people at this time. So not all the scandals have come out yet.
No, you're right. They came in after his death.
He's one of the highest popularity ratings of any president. That when he dies and they begin to bring his body out of California, 9 million people line the streets.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have to check that. I think that's more than who came and saw Kennedy interned. I mean,
probably.
Like he is beloved by the people. He was tall. He was athletic. He was outgoing. He was charismatic. He was an actor. Can we use the term?
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of all he was. Like, he was beloved by the people, but he didn't have the intellect for it.
No.
He definitely didn't have the ethics or the integrity for it, but he was just a really good – he was a good face.
Yeah, and in fact, he got his start because he gave the speech at the convention that nominated William Howard Taft
that's
for
correct.
President.
Yeah.
And then he appoints William Howard Taft
that's
to
correct.
The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So he's a great orator. He's
yes,
a charismatic
he is.
Individual.
Yes.
But content-wise and character-wise, he just – he was devoid.
Yes.
And it, you know, 2 years, I guess, it was kind of – the result of his lifestyle. I don't know. 57. He 57. Died at 57.
So we're not exactly, again, there's all a mystery. The original doctors used the term stroke, which looking back, it's probably not a stroke. Later, medical historian said, well, it's a heart attack. And then some of the most recent research is that some of his doctors were giving him heavy laxatives to help him heal, and that more than likely might have taxed his heart because they said that he actually, he's a very large guy for his size, very tall, very athletic. So he probably had a large heart. And those heavy laxatives and dehydration may have caused the heart attack. We don't know. And then, of course,
there's... And we never will.
We never will. And then, of course, there's the conspiracy theory that he was poisoned. So,
yeah.
But again, we're not going... There's no historical facts for that. But it's just... It's a really interesting end to a really corrupt president. And as you said, that the Teapot Dome scandal was something that really, really marked his presidency because that comes out after his death. And now they start the trial for all of this. And then to further the destruction of his legacy, Nan Britton, this young 18-year-old girl who fathers an illegitimate child for him, writes a book in 1927 called The President's Daughter, which is an interesting book, actually. I have a copy of it on my shelf. I haven't had the chance to read it yet, but I've thumbed through it. But The President's Daughter actually is this account written by her about how Harding basically woos her, has a child with her, and then covers the whole thing up and has the Secret Service pay her off the whole time.
And
is all this keep breaking, Harding's popularity drops, and it depends on the poll, but in some presidential polls, he's at the very bottom.
Yes.
He's the very bottom of all presidents. And you can kind of see why.
Yeah, unfortunately, you're absolutely right. Poor guy. You know, he brings it on himself, though.
He does bring it on himself. It is self-inflicted in so many ways.
He's the last of the front porch presidential candidates. You know, he campaigns from his front porch. And he campaigns so much they have to gravel his yard because they've killed all the grass.
I think the one that was that usually crowds up to 10,000.
Yeah.
Can you... I often think this because this is really before any advanced PA systems at all. You know, we lecture all the time, right? We lecture for a living. And I've stood in front of, you know, freshman classes that are lecture halls, maybe 80 students, and you talk and you talk and you talk. I can't imagine trying to lecture for hours to 10,000 people.
I cannot. I don't know how you would deliver it. How does your voice carry?
I don't know. But like you said, he's the last of the front porch politicians. And his wife is one of the major movers and shakers in this. She's one of the major reasons why this happens. And it's interesting that it comes on the heels of Wilson, because you just had Edith Wilson, who more than likely is running the White House. And now you have Flossie Harding. And in many ways, Florence Harding is kind of running the show behind it, too. So you have these back-to-back presidents with these mothering figures who may be running the White House more than their husband actually was.
Yep.
And then, of course, this is going to give rise to Coolidge. And there's some really interesting stuff with Coolidge. And one of the things that you and I have seen throughout this podcast that we see is there are these waves with politics in American history, these trends.
Right.
And they pick up and they last for a while, and then they die off. And typically what happens is we see a complete pendulum effect, right, this swing that goes from one side to the other. And maybe the swing to this style of leadership is FDR, who will arise in a few decades. And FDR is basically saying he wants all the leadership and power for himself, if you will.
Yeah, and he transforms the whole federal government.
And he concentrates power within the executive branch, specifically within this idea of the executive order and the president's power.
Right.
And I do believe that is a pendulum swing from weaker presidents like Wilson and like Harding, who in many ways, I guess you could say, and we talked about this before, they strengthen the legislative side, and specifically after the Teapot Dome scandal, there is the passing of Congress having more oversight over the interior and taking it away from the executive branch, and the legislative branch begins to grow, which was probably the founders' intent. And maybe we're biased because the way I teach this, and of course you were in Congress, maybe we're both a little biased on this. But I think the founding fathers probably wanted the legislative side to have more power and the executive side to have less power. So maybe this is a return to founders' intent anyway. And I would say from Roosevelt onward, maybe
it
not.
It changes dramatically in the
Reagan
other direction.
Reagan is an attempt to peel that back some in the 80s. And I think he's probably the only one post-Roosevelt who will attempt to peel back some of the power of the executive office.
Yes, and then the regulatory control that's out there.
Yes.
You know? The bureaucracy, as they say.
Yes. But it's interesting, every time there are these weaker presidents, there's a growth in legislative power.
Yes.
So maybe the weaker president allows the legislative power to grow. Maybe they're not keeping each other in check as much. Or maybe when there's a weak president, the legislative power sees the need to grow to fill in the gaps. I'm not sure what that is.
And I'm not sure where we go from here, because I think that we have this battle now between the legislative and the executive that we haven't seen in the past with all these impeachment proceedings that we've seen over the last couple of years, the threat of impeachment of cabinet members, let alone the president's. You know, there's this battle of wills, if you will. Mm-hmm. Who's got more power, the executive or the legislative side? And neither probably has more power than the other or shouldn't.
Yeah, it almost feels like it's a playoff run in sports, right? And they're fighting and fighting, but it's like, guys, you're on the same team. I think somewhere along the way we forgot that, right?
Yeah.
You're not fighting for a championship trophy. You're like, y'all are on the same team.
Yep, and the greater good.
And for the American people, right?
Amen.
For the consent of the governed. But somewhere along the way we have completely lost that.
Yeah.
Moving forward, what do you see? Who do you think is going to get more power at post-2024 election, the executive branch or the legislative branch? Or can you not make that prediction yet?
Well, it depends on who wins. I think if Trump wins this election, then they will concentrate more in the executive. Because I think that he will grab at it, whether he's empowered by the
legislature.
Yeah, whether Congress gives him the power or not, he will assert it through executive orders to the extreme that he can. If it's Biden, it depends on whether we keep a Republican Congress or a Democrat Congress.
Okay.
If it's a Democrat Congress, then you know he may let them empower themselves even more. But again, you know, he's a much older gentleman. I mean,
yes.
He'll be the oldest president we've ever had.
That is correct.
So
that is correct.
But the battle will continue.
It will. And we see the roots for some of these battles already taking place already in the early 20s. But before this, of course. But
yes.
Now we find, I think, the snowball effect beginning to intensify under the presidency of men like Wilson and Hardin. This is where we see kind of the beginning of that steamrolling effect.
I think you're right.
So, we said going into this is going to be a short one because there's not a whole lot we can say positive about
Hardin.
And unfortunately, and as you said, he decimated his own legacy. He was a corrupt man with a corrupt legacy who worked with a corrupt cabinet.
Yes.
And then we see him having a short life, and then we'll pick up on Coolidge and kind of an interesting segue to some more powerful leaders.
Yeah, we'll finish the semester with Calvin Coolidge.
Yes. So. Stay cool with Coolidge, right?
Absolutely. Great slogan.
Yes, absolutely. So this has been Presence in Politics. Thank you so much.
Thank you.